Hello, folks. Today I have Michael Dehan with me. It's a great pleasure to have you here, Michael.
Oh, yeah. Thank you very much for having me.
And Michael, can you tell us a little bit about your current job, what you're doing right now?
So I'm sort of trying to figure that out. I guess most people would probably know me from creating Ansible, which is a pretty large configuration management system. So I've kind of gotten out of programming a little bit and trying to help some companies learn from the lessons from that particular startup and sort of how to do some of those kind of same projects in the DevOps space. So I guess that's that. Probably more interesting to talk about some of the past stuff.
Okay, talking about some of the past stuff, can you tell us how did you get into computers and technology?
Yeah, sure. So I guess my first computer was like a 286 that my family had in like elementary school, and it then there was like a 486 a little bit later. So I was I think after a little bit of exposure to like basic programming in eighth grade, I was like doing a little bit of QBasic stuff here and there. I got into trouble for programming a Minesweeper clone in the middle on my Texas Instruments calculator in English class. So that was a good time. So just like really easy kind of simple things and so on. From there, I originally tried in college, I tried to go into electrical engineering. And I just kind of decided that I didn't, or computer engineering. And I sort of decided that I didn't like circuits and I liked the programming stuff more. So kind of got into it that way. And my career was sort of stumbling into where could I find a job, right? And then the systems management stuff that I ended up writing wasn't really something I was looking for. It was just like kind of a result of the area that I was in, had a bunch of jobs kind of in that area, and one thing kind of led to another.
You mentioned briefly some exposure to technology during elementary school. How did high school go for you? So did you have some exposure to programming languages? You mentioned QBasic, Basic. Did you learn anything else during high school? Was it pretty much a college that you got more into the programming side of things?
So I was doing a little bit of stuff on my own during high school, but we had an AP computer science class that I took in like 11th grade, and it was Turbo Pascal. And I ended up helping out some of the other people in that class. And super helpful or just kind of like another language at that point. College was, it originally started out in C++, and then they were like in the early stages of switching to Java at that point. So I never really used Pascal after that. Today, I would hope people would start with like Python or JavaScript or something.
That's an interesting topic that you just mentioned here, because usually one question that we hear a lot is which language do we choose to start, right? So how do I start? Which language do I start? It's kind of interesting that you mentioned Python, JavaScript, because it's exactly what we recommend to the people who are joining the group and trying to learn how to code. And how did that evolve for you until you got to your first job? You said you had a few jobs, but do you remember like the first job?
Yeah, my first job, like out of college, like my first non-internship job was working for IBM, because what happened in 2000 is for anybody that wasn't around then, we had the dot-com crash where I guess like advertising revenue dried up and a lot of companies were cutting back. I got a job that was writing software to manage the utility programs around storage controllers. So this is RAID, redundant array of inexpensive disks. And maintaining a very, very large C program, and it wasn't very well organized. So it had 20,000 lines of code, and it was split into two files. And the reason it was in two files was the DOS compiler choked after 10,000 lines. So I got in really early, and it was like I was a guy that was really into like object-oriented programming architecture, and I ended up having to like learn C and learn like Linux really for real when I wasn't a Linux fan. And I did grow to like it. But writing code on a lot of different operating systems in a very like more low level way. My very first internship though, was like this really giant, horrible Excel spreadsheet for this auto insurance company that took like 2 minutes to run. And then, but I did have another cool one on the way, working for this like sort of local phone company doing some like Unix like batch programming and Perl and stuff like that. So yeah, it wasn't as glamorous as I thought it would be, because like I was originally thinking was going to do like computer graphics or robotics or like some really cool kind of industry things. And it was all kind of really fortuitous, because we were talking a little bit before we hit the record button. You know, like one thing does kind of lead to another. And like Ansible and some other things I don't think would have happened without kind of stumbling into some other things kind of in a roundabout way.
You mentioned Linux briefly. Do you remember what kind of distribution it was back then, and how did you get your Linux? You mentioned that you're not sure, kind of a big fan of Linux to start, but then you got you like it?
So in back in college, we had a lot of Solaris machines, and they were pretty reliable, and they had the reflective mouse pads and everything, and they were starting to be Linux machines, and they were always less reliable. And our school actually had their own, I guess, like distribution or something like that. For work, we had a lot more distributions back then. There was Red Hat there, but at the same time, obviously Debian existed and Ubuntu existed, I think it existed, but that we had, you know, all these other things like, I can't even remember them. Like, I think like TurboDog and all these, SUSE was still kind of, around then. At home, I started running, Debian, and I was a pretty big fan of that for a while. Back when I'd run my own servers and so on.
Yeah, I think the first distribution I ever used was Mandrake back in 95, I think. And back in Brazil, there was no such thing as being able to download an ISO file, right? So we had to order the CDs, and that came from the US. There was a company named Singtel. Not sure if you ever dealt with them, but Walnut Creek was the brand that I think they had, and that's how we got Linux. But how did work evolve for you? So how did you, and you mentioned that you're working for IBM at some point in time, and how did you end up at Red Hat?
So there was a sort of an intermediate company along the way, and it was just around the corner from where I worked. So I was looking for a new job, and I got, there was a company around the corner that was doing digital video solutions for like police departments. So back then there weren't a lot of, there weren't body cameras on people, because embedded stuff really wasn't capable of doing it, but we were starting to put cameras in cars, and there was they had a digital system for that. And their technology was based on Python. So I was, at the time, I liked Perl. I was sort of learning Ruby. So like it wasn't too big of a jump to move to Python, and that Python experience, when that company kind of failed, was good enough resume experience to get a job at Red Hat, because they were also in the area and they were looking for, I guess, like people with dynamic programming language experience and so on. Probably also kind of leveraging that history of doing some systems management stuff in the past. But Red Hat had this pretty cool group at the time. They had this emerging technologies thing. And basically what that meant is employees could mostly decide what to do without too much direction from like up top or whatever. So what happened, I worked for a really cool guy I'd later work with a little bit later at another systems manager company, but he left, and for a long time I didn't have a boss. So what happened was I just decided to make IRC chat my boss, right? And I started really getting into listening to the community and what do they want, right? And at the time, Red Hat was pretty good about being like very open source with Fedora, but a lot of the tools that they made for their customers were kind of only nominally community oriented. They might be open source, but were they really like community driven and developed in the open? I'm getting ahead of myself. So
So at some point in time in I think you're working at Red Hat, and how did the idea about creating, I think it was Cobbler that came first, right?
Yeah, so at the time, virtualization was really new. So at least in terms of Linux. So Xen, X-E-N, was kind of the one that most people were looking at the time. KVM was just starting to become a thing. Red Hat hadn't yet bought the company that made KVM. So we were looking for tools that would allow people to more easily install virtual machines. And at the same time, we were kind of looking at Pixie boot infrastructure, which is how you bootstrap a physical server. How do you fully automate that install? Red Hat had a language called Kickstart. Debian's got this thing called Preseed. So how do you audit? I think the idea kind of came together. Let's make something that works for both of these things, like physical systems and virtual systems. And it probably could have got done early, and we could have stopped and done something else, but there was community interest, and I kind of found all the little corners around those areas and kind of kept working on them, and then asking people that were running much, much bigger infrastructures than I knew anything about, what ideas do you have? What would be cool in these kinds of tools? What works for you and what doesn't? And got really into like kind of listening to the community. And in those days, this was like pre-GitHub, a lot more conversation happened on email mailing lists and so on. And I think that was actually really good, because we had a lot more talking about how the software should be versus people just giving you code and trying to work on it. So there was more conversations, I think, and learning from the community, and they were probably more aware about what we did rather than just consuming like the software that got released. It was weird, because I was writing software that was deploying some, you know, render farms for movies and large banks and all these other things. But realistically, I had like two machines on my desk. So it was kind of like, I don't know if this the idiom translates to your audience. It's kind of like playing a doctor on television, right? You're like, I've written this automation software that can be used for these very large infrastructures, and then I've got two computers on my desk and like no lab. I think it all worked out.
It's absolutely fantastic, right? And I think it translates well. I think the fact that even though you're producing stuff that it's going to be used at large scale, your lab was small, if you think of that way, right? But how you mentioned that you didn't have GitHub at the time, right? So you mentioned team collaboration, community. How was it back then when there was no GitHub, and how was the whole collaboration contribution to open source project like we have today, even the use of Git as well? How was it back then?
Yeah, so I think my memory of things is fuzzy. So we were, I was using Git at one point. I think we were exploring Mercurial at the time. So version control wasn't very different, but like there was IRC for chat, and I know there's been some problems with Freenode, and people have moved to different servers since. But chat remains. Chat works the same way today. But basically the mailing lists existed, where people that were really interested in the program could ask questions, and we could kind of communicate about releases and talk about what was coming up. And that's one of my surprises about GitHub is GitHub, while it is something where everybody has an account and everybody can share code and file bugs, it's not conversational. So in those days, I thought that we did a really good job of working together across like company boundaries of different people sharing ideas, and it felt like it was very, very collaborative. Whereas I think today it may feel a little bit more like people are expecting companies to develop software, and then that the free software is just stuff that they download and you consume, right? So, or that you just assume that a community is going to log in and fix bugs, but they never really form the same kind of relationship with you. Later on, when I would do Ansible had a mailing list, and that mailing list was good, and that community was there. but I think it was maybe a little bit harder because like not everyone is on the mailing list or not everybody's in chat. So you do get people that were more apt to file a bug, but not keep up with the discussion, or maybe they'd send you code and not really understand what you were working on because GitHub isn't like conversation first. It's kind of like code first. But on the other hand, the good thing is that everybody having an account does mean that like more people are going to log into your bug tracker and you're going to get more bug reports. And that itself was a good thing.
So besides the Coupler, you did some work with Funk as well, right? Can you tell us a little bit about Funk?
Yeah, so Funk was written with Adrian Likens, who wrote UpToDate, and Seth Vidal, who wrote Yum, which is was the package manager for a long time, and they're both really awesome. So our idea was to just get together and make something that we could get done in a couple weeks that would fill in some of the gaps between what we do to install a system, which might be Cobbler, and what we do to configure a system once it's installed, which at the time was tools like CFEngine or Puppet, as we were kind of pushing at the time. Today, maybe it's Ansible, maybe it's not. But there was a gap between configuration and this automation of the install and pushing files out to the boxes. Whereas sometimes you just wanted to do something like right now. Maybe you just wanted to reboot a bunch of servers. Maybe you wanted to install a hotfix. Maybe you just wanted to check all your servers to see how much disk space you have on all of them. So those kind of like one-shot tasks were a gap that was that couldn't be done in the configuration management tools because they would have to like run every 30 minutes or whatever, and they didn't really report information out. So that was a pretty fun project. It got to be used to inside Fedora's like build system a little bit. It got used to deploy, I think, some chip design clusters here and there. But it kind of laid some of the foundations to Ansible in some ways. So there was an idea I had about building a configuration management tool on top of Funk at the time, called Remote Rocket Surgery, and it got killed kind of for like political reasons at one point, and it never got built. But like, it was always kind of in the back of my mind, like, what if we had something that worked like that, that could do orchestration? When I say orchestration, I mean like ordering actions to occur on servers at particular points in time, as well as configure them. But Red Hat was really cool at those times because like anybody could start a project and like if you got community people to use it, you could kind of work on it. I think like it was a good launch pad at the time too, because people were kind of listening to those channels. It's not enough to like release an open source project sometime. You got to think about like, who am I going to get to try this out and how am I going to find people? So because we had, Cobbler's mailing list and Cobbler kind of launched off of another mailing list that existed before, there was kind of a place to say, hey, I'm trying this new thing. What do you think? Right. So definitely helpful.
So you mentioned that you're kind of thinking about why eventually became Ansible at some point in time, right? So I just wonder if you could go back a little bit in time and tell us about how did the idea about Ansible, materialize, and how did you get to work on Ansible and release the product at some point in time?
Sure. Part of it was that previous experience back when working with Cobbler and Funk and seeing people that were using Puppet. And I kind of had a few intermediate jobs along the way. I actually worked for Puppet Labs for a very short amount of time early on. It was mostly a good experience. But I ended up having to use it a few times later, and build integrations with it. And, wasn't exactly quite what I wanted with how, you would hook up the remote components and some of the language things. So, what happened was, I was at this one company and I was kind of bored and I wanted another open source project cause I didn't have one. So I just decided at that point, well, let's build an automation system that would be like kind of basic, that would just just log into systems through SSH, through Secure Shell, not have the same daemon problems that Puppet has, and incorporate the ability to like install software and configure systems with the ability to just do things on them when I want in very specific orders. So I started that kind of as just like a nights and weekends project. And I don't remember the exact specifics anymore, but I announced it on like the Cobbler mailing list because I knew some people there kind of knew who I was still. And it was, I'm building this thing. And it was kind of done at the right point in time where people had understood configuration management, but they also understood the problems and they did want simpler tools. So we kind of got some early interest from some people that I respected from that previous community, and also from a few current and former Red Hat people that it seemed like a good idea to keep working on it. And that it took off like pretty quickly from there. I remember when I started, I was like, hey, if I've got like 40 people on a mailing list, I'll be like perfectly successful and happy, right? And that was pretty quick. Every project kind of has to get launched at like the right time when the market wants it. And that was an accident. It wasn't planned, but I think if Ansible had, probably would not have been successful if it was launched too much earlier, because people would have assumed like, oh, these other things are dominant. I haven't yet experienced them enough to realize what I don't like about them. Or if it launched like too much later, there's this trend now where everybody wants to like Dockerize everything and Kubernetes things and microservices, and they make everything like way too complicated. So my individual approach at minimalism was like the right time to do in like 2012. Trying to get that same, like a better version of that today, people might not be as interested. So that's like, I guess like the one takeaway I would tell everybody is like everything has its time and place, right?
Michael, I think Ansible is written in Python, correct?
Yes, definitely. I think like Python is really good for systems management tools in a way, because like it's easy for everybody to read. So the whole, for those that aren't familiar with like this whole DevOps thing, I don't really buy into most of the religion around DevOps or the hype or anything like that. But in the beginning, it was about sysadmins that wanted to use code and tools to automate their infrastructure, to be able to not have to manage systems one at a time. And systems administrators have been doing that for eons with scripts that they've written. It was really just about bringing people together to share the same scripts and share the same tools instead of everybody having to build their own. Python was great because like it's very readable for everybody. It doesn't try to make things complicated. It's really hard to write like super ugly code in Python unless you try. It has most of the language capabilities that you'd want. Maybe it's not the fastest thing, but it was perfect for the job at the time.
At some point in time, I think that Ansible was among the top 10 most contributed to projects on GitHub, correct?
Yeah, I don't know the current numbers, but it was up there for a while. Ansible got to be that way, I guess, because it was very modular. So everything it talked to, whether that was like a package manager, like or a, you know, a service or whatever it went out and was able to operate with, was a module. And modularity is a really important concept, I think, in most end user programs, because it allows, especially when they're open source, because it allows somebody to make a contribution without like understanding the whole thing. So everybody's able to like look at the tools in the toolbox and say, okay, Ansible came with like 57 screwdrivers and 12 hammers and a wrench. And they're like, oh, I want this different wrench. Well, they can make the wrench and then we can put it in the toolbox, right? That modularity is what made that work, right? So plugins, basically. Super powerful concept. Like a lot of people don't, if you have an open source program, a lot of people might not work on the core of the program. The core might be pretty complicated and a lot of work. But if you make a good interface that makes it easy to extend, you don't have to understand the whole program to write an extension. And that can be also a good way to potentially learn to work in a new code base. So yeah, that's where most of the stats came from. It was a great experience working with a lot of those people. Got to hear some cool stories. also like kind of demanding, because like, how do you make decisions when different people have like contrasting viewpoints? So I think one of the reasons we were successful too was we did know when to say no, but also tried to make like pragmatic decisions, listening to like what's good for everybody. There are challenges of managing a community of that size, and communication is one of them, like really trying to explain what you're doing. And another one is like trying to be really consistent, because if somebody wants to work on a module, they might not always copy the same module. They may start work based on another module. So any error you make quickly like gets copied around and kind of adds to the inertia of being able to change anything. So how do you design an interface that people are going to be able to stick to?
Think about the success of the project and the size of the community involved to help push it forward. And you just mentioned some of the potential challenges here of people working together. So what did you guys do, and what did you do to keep everybody together on the same page and evolving and ensuring that the product was pushing forward in the right way?
Initially, there like wasn't a company behind Ansible, and that came to exist later. And those guys did a lot of great work in working with people that wanted to contribute and so on. But I think like it's very important to over-communicate. And the other one is to write very, very good documentation that explains things. And knowing that people come in with different preferences and learning styles, that they have different backgrounds, that somebody may be an expert in one thing and not know another thing. So how can you write your documentation almost like a choose your own adventure book, right? So different people are going to want to drill down and find out things that they don't understand, or see what something can do and skim over other parts. So I probably spent like 40% of my time in the first year on just like documentation and reading everybody's comments and complaints on Twitter. I'm not on Twitter anymore. Trying to make sure that it accommodated their questions and anticipated the questions that they didn't ask. And I think a lot of technical products don't do that. They try to make themselves seem complicated. And I think I was always kind of dumb or whatever. I didn't want to make things complicated. I wanted to make people feel like they were like kind of powerful and they could figure things out, and that you could use the tech to help them be excited about new things.
I was hoping you could tell us some of the use cases that you saw some companies and organizations in general using Ansible.
It's been a little while, so I don't necessarily have it all at the top of my head. I saw some recent information that I guess it was Red Hat IBM's estimation that it's like 60% of the Fortune 500 are using Ansible now. But back then, it started off a lot with really small startups doing cloud things. But it later got on into, you know, pieces of eBay and PayPal and banks. I remember seeing a video where Electronic Arts was using it to deploy Overwatch, which is like one public one I could definitely talk to. It got used inside of SpaceX. It got used to deploy like other video gaming systems. So like, it's just like really general purpose. So anybody that needed to configure a system and install it could pretty much be using it. So the actual technology, it doesn't vary very much between one place or the other. It's not that exciting. It's really like, what are people... I always like thought it was more exciting to hear what kind of things that they were deploying, right? But installing software it later acquired some cloud configuration features. So like configuring Amazon was a big early one, right, for a lot of people. How do you orchestrate like a rolling update? So if everybody's got version one of the software and then you want to deploy version two of the software and not have it be halfway version one and halfway version two at the same time, but basically like just like a snapping your fingers, move from version two to version one, or from version one to version two, right? That was a kind of a big early use case that it was, I won't say exactly designed for, but kind of designed for, because I was working at one company before that was doing like rolling updates and stuff like that. And then none of the existing tools would kind of fit in. So it's software installation regardless, but there was definitely some cool companies along the way.
How has life evolved for you and also Ansible since then?
I don't know if it's evolved for me too much. I'm kind of watching the tech landscape change a lot, right? So everybody kind of decided to embrace immutable systems as a concept. And for those that don't know what that means, it's like, I don't really reconfigure a server. I'm just going to redeploy it. That was something that got pushed a long time ago, but it just started to get popular. But then people are doing crazy things, in my opinion, like running clouds on top of clouds, and there's multiple levels of stacks, and people are running hundreds and hundreds of microservices. So I kind of feel like I was trying to propose minimalism and architectural simplicity to an extent. And folks have kind of gone into maximalism. So like, if you look up the quote, the Cloud Native Computing Foundation landscape or whatever, and see these like hundreds upon hundreds of projects backed by all these large companies and startups. And it's very hard to explain what any of it does or why you would need it if you're running on top of particular clouds. So, I mean, I see movement in a different direction on the deployment space. And I don't really know that like the rest of software has really changed all that much. I tend to at least look back at software from 10 to 20 plus years ago when things were managed more traditionally as being better. I think that there's a lot of pressure from like Scrum organizations to make people make decisions quickly and make short-term decisions instead of long-term decisions, and put people into too many status meetings and not enough time spent in design and research and things like that. So that may be related, how we keep kind of just like adding things to the stack versus like trying to go back and simplify. But maybe at some point in the future, we do go back and simplify and try to have less moving parts again.
I was hoping that you could explore a bit more some of the minimalist ideas that you have, and perhaps, and the way I'm thinking here is maybe we're contributing to the introduction of a substantial technical debt because of some of the decisions that we have been making.
Yeah, we may be. I don't know that they're my ideas, but when I started doing software, I didn't really have experience to like quote web scale systems, but I eventually did. I was working for a couple companies that had customer facing properties, and one of them was an online homework system. And really, when you think about how software on the web works, you have multiple copies of machines that are running the same software, and you have a load balancer that's moving traffic between those machines, and that's how you scale. You don't necessarily need a bigger and bigger computer, but if you write it, your code with efficiently, you need less of them, right? That is easily doable in many companies with a very minimum number of images or types of machines, right? So you usually have like one type. You could have one type of machine that honors the web request that the browser hits. You might have another type of machine that runs in the backend that handles all your asynchronous jobs. And maybe there's a couple of different types of those. And we might call those services, right? They might be connected together with a message bus. So that was the kind of architecture that I got used to and that I really wrote Ansible thinking about. And those architectures are perfectly compatible with the cloud. Typically, people would just run EC2 images, possibly built immutably, possibly built with Ansible, maybe not. Packer was popular. But anyway, so you could get away with having three types of images. Today, people tend to deploy these very large microservices things where there might be 50, there might be 100 different types of images. Everybody is choosing their own programming languages. There's lots more builds in the system. And then there's like some sort of orchestrator thing on top, like Kubernetes. And then there's maybe something orchestrating Kubernetes, like Helm, which I'm not super familiar with. You're running additional types of service discovery tools in the system so that your services can find each other. These were problems that like we never really had before. I think part of it to me feels like people are searching for resume skills because it's popular. But if we follow ideas because they're popular, not just in tech, but in life, right? We're never really in control of our destiny, right? The idea is alive, but we're just kind of like following it. It's how we get like populism, right? It's a bad thing. So I think a lot of our architecture kind of is driven today by consumerism and the idea that somebody wants to have a startup, and that if they have enough resources to go to the right conferences and have enough salespeople, we can push really complicated things. Whereas, I won't pretend Ansible wasn't a company, but when I started it, it wasn't supposed to be. And I told myself, if this ever supports a consultancy, I will have failed in what I was trying to do and make something really simple that never required a book, that never required a consultant, right? We never actually sold consulting when I was a company, but that's beside the point. But I think a lot of it now is driven by that desire to people to sell things and to tell you that your system isn't right unless it's really, really complicated. And to me, like, the simpler systems are better. I wanted people to be able to get done with their operation stuff and get back to coding, right? Because that's what I enjoyed. I was still a developer, even though I wrote a lot of systems deployment kind of tools. That was another thing. I was like, if this becomes somebody's day job, I've probably failed, right? And it definitely had become people's day job because I wanted it to get out of the way, right? What is simple to me is how few types of images and how few types of services can I have? Can I share code with libraries instead of microservices? Can I have less moving parts so less things break, so people are on call for less periods of time, and that your cloud bills can be really, really low versus really, really expensive? Because Amazon and their competitors do not have any reason to make computing simple for you. They have every reason to tell you that you should buy lots of their services, right? But you really don't need that many. Like, one of the cool things about cloud should have been, we're giving people the tools to deploy a load balancer and some images and learn all the basics and keep it really inexpensive for everybody and just let them scale when they need to. And I think a lot of people are chasing this idea that I need to be doing things all the big companies are doing, and it feels like it's a little bit of maybe a shared delusion. And I know some people have that opinion, but it's, I don't know. That's just kind of just the way I see it.
Yeah, going back to the beginning of your career here, is there anything special that you think you should or could have done in a different way?
I don't know. I mean, it's like, I think the one thing to do is for everybody is to try to find the place where you're happy, right? And I will not pretend that I was happy for every place that I was at ever. It's hard. So people are generally pretty tolerant of people switching jobs to try to, and I would say that you learn from all the different places you're at. You learn something, even if it's just what not to do, it affects your experience. I found out later that I was really interested in product management, and that's really, I think, what I'm most interested in. I might, in terms of like tech and software, so I might have tried to tailor my career a little bit differently. The other thing is that I find like some of the more harder engineerings, like I really liked it when I was working for hardware companies, and they tend to have a different way of managing a company and deliverables and sometimes do some cooler things, like when you see your code like actually interacting with the physical world. So I might have tried to do that as well. But I think it all ended up in an interesting way. But yeah, I'd say the big thing is make sure you're doing what you like, and if not, figure that out.
Michael, I was hoping you could tell us a little bit more, because you mentioned earlier in the conversation here that at some point in time, you probably spend like 40% of your time doing documentation and reading what other people are saying about the product that you're building. And sometimes people have the impression that as a programmer, you're going to be doing coding 100% of the time. So I was hoping you could explore a little bit more the experience, especially like you mentioned, as a product manager, and you're taking care of a much bigger problem than just the code, right? So can you elaborate a little bit more on that topic?
Yeah, I guess that's why like Ansible was probably successful, is kind of looking at things from an overall like holistic perspective. So in order to get people to use software, a lot of times people will describe it in these very convoluted terms that you don't really know what it does. And I have this problem. I read so many vendor tool pages and I have no idea what it does. So if anybody's feeling that way, you're not alone. And I think they're just trying to generate phone calls and then and sell people on stuff. And that's the wrong way to do it. I kind of wanted to build a community, right, where people were legitimately wanting to talk and bringing their own ideas. And the tool evolved from listening to everybody because all the users were smarter than I was always, right? So it's like they have ideas for things that I can't even imagine. What I can do is kind of create a catalyst for that community to come together, a framework, and kind of steer it. Whereas like I might have more software and organizational skills, but the sysadmins that were using my tool know way more about managing systems in the real world and the workloads and all that kind of stuff. So how can I learn from them? In order to kind of create that world, you have to do a lot more than just like just put out a README, right? You have to make sure you understand people's perceptions and what problems they have, and provide really, really good customer support. Because like somebody could have a problem when a product is really early, and because you spent 20 minutes or an hour helping them, they can stay loyal to your project and they could become like one of your big major champions, or they could contribute a really nice feature or a really great idea. But if they're just frustrated, they can't figure out how to install your thing, they're going to go somewhere else, right? And I think that's the problem with most of GitHub is people haven't thought about the way that they market and present their ideas. There's just a README. People are going to follow a link. That link is going to give them other choices. They're going to get lost and they're going to give up. So the really best lesson I ever learned from Seth Vidal, who worked on Funk with me, and Adrian, he said people have to be successful in 30 minutes or like within their lunch hour, or they're going to go away. Like now, I think with like more cell phone usage and more YouTube algorithms and Twitter and social media, people have greater attention deficits and are more impatient. So like you really need to be able to explain things quickly, help them see how like something would work for them, and then like anticipate the ways that they're going to get stuck. And not everybody's going to be able to think about it the way that you do. So that component is, I think, why Ansible was able to like get going. And that's like when you're just thinking about building software and writing, you know, interesting, complicated code, nobody else really knows what's going on. Like most people aren't going to read your code, right? So if what they have is the documentation and you don't write any, or it's not very good, what's going to give them anything to know about what you're doing, right? So there's a lot of grunt work to kind of push anything over the edge. Like it takes a lot of work.
As I mentioned to you, the Os Programadores community, it's a mix, right? There's several people who are trying to understand if technology and programming is something that they should be getting into. There are some people that know something, they're trying to improve what they know. And what would you recommend to those people? Those who are kind of wondering if programming technology is something that they should be getting into and develop that as a career?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good question, right? So I don't say it's like negative. I don't want to be negative or anything, but the way that software is managed in the real world is different than you experience it as a hobbyist, and it's different than you experience it in like a software industry. So if you want to work at a place that you can make a lot of impact and that you enjoy the experience, a lot of times you can find some, I guess I would say, is like, don't just consider pure tech companies, right? People that are making tools for other tech companies, or that are like very like, you know, like Silicon Valley memes or whatever. Some of the really cool things you can do are places that just have a little bit of software and they're helping people in the real world. Like the one place where I was doing the police digital video thing, right? Policemen are very, very grateful for having very small features added, or when you can write a feature that, you know, you like, you know, your parents can actually use and see and experience or whatever. So software is everywhere now. So I guess like just don't think about it being in terms of like pure tech companies, because the way that some of those are managed right now can be super stressful. And that might not be for you, even if you love programming, but there's still opportunities to do some interesting programming stuff that on the side on your own or whatever, or kind of for hobby purposes. And, you know, maybe you don't want to cross the streams, but I would say like look at companies that have hardware, look at companies that are doing, you know, direct e-commerce and other things like that, that are perhaps, and then there's also just a big difference in culture between like small and large companies as well, right? There's benefits in to both of those. So kind of maybe explore both of them and kind of see which ones work better for you.
Do you have any recommendations about books, music, movies, games, or anything else that you may wish to recommend?
The off-topic section of the program. Yeah, so that's a hard one because like there's too many bands and musics and things. So Ansible was named as a reference to a small piece of Orson Scott Card's Ender's Game. So that was like one of my early favorite books. It's the Ansible part was about kind of the idea of controlling a whole bunch of ships at once. I'm a big fan of Frank Herbert's Dune, obviously a science fiction classic of sorts. It gets more weird as it goes on, and it's like six books, but lots of weird little quotes. The whole idea of like seeing the world as a field of probability of what can happen and might happen, and what is kind of like this golden path is kind of a metaphor of surviving a startup in a way. So I don't really think I have any movie suggestions. Music-wise, I'm kind of a classic rock guy, so I like a lot of things, but my favorite band is probably Van Halen. I like Iron Maiden, especially some of the newer, more synthesizer stuff, Pink Floyd. Kind of newer stuff, they're no longer around, but there's a noise rock band called Parts and Labor that sounds pretty cool. I like a lot of things with synthesizers. Elton 11 is kind of this like two guys with a loop pedal and a guitar and drums and I don't know, kind of like a little bit of everything, right? So what was your last question? So you said books, movies, and music.
And games?
Yeah. Oh, games. There was a lot of games that I played when I was a kid that like I miss, right? I used to play a lot of Warcraft 2 and SimCity 2000 and Civilization 2 and some things like that. And these days, not so much. I just finished playing God of War 3 Ragnarok, which was really, really good. So if anybody's got a PS4 or PS5 and wants to try that, the writing is great. Christopher Judge from Stargate is like the main actor, and it's like got, you know, giant turtles and stuff. So that was fun for me. Have to find the next thing though.
That sounds like a very good list of things to do here. So thank you for that. Are there any questions that you believe I should have had to ask and today and I did not ask?
I don't know. Maybe the question to ask is, what questions do you think you should have asked? I'm kidding on that one. I don't think I have any. Good questions all around.
And is anything you'd like to share with the audience here in terms of contact information, website, blog? I think you have a blog, right?
Yeah, I'm kind of trying to disassociate it with my real identity or whatever. So yeah, not too much. I haven't been blogging so much about tech stuff lately. It's more about hobbies and synthesizers and photography things and whatever else. I'll definitely pass my email address. If anybody wants to email me, it's michael@michaeldehaan.net. And, you know, happy to talk shop on any IT operation stuff or anything like that.
And how is photography going for you?
I haven't really done a lot lately. So COVID kind of got me in a rut where I wasn't, like going to new places, but it's fun. I've got a couple Leicas and use some Adobe Lightroom for processing some stuff, and it's fun.
What kind of camera gear do you have?
I've got a Leica M10 now. I used to use some Canon digital SLR kind of bits. It's not really so much about the gear, right? I think everything kind of takes good photos now. Still a little better to have something that's not a cell phone, sometimes for like long exposures. But I was just even using like the whatever iPhone I have the other day, and it's like night mode starting to beat my camera. So interesting times. It's good stuff.
Yeah, it's pretty impressive to see how the cell phone cameras have evolved, right? So it's pretty cool stuff. Yeah, Michael, I just... I want to take a moment here to thank you. It's almost 9 p.m. here your time, so it's a Monday evening. And thank you so much for taking time to speak with me and to share the fantastic career here and all the stories that you have been able to share with us. Greatly appreciated.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you very much for having me. Very nice talking with you as well.
Thank you, and happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to you too.
Thank you.
Chegamos ao final de mais um episódio. Agradeço a todos a atenção. E o nosso site é osprogramadores.com. Participem e até o próximo episódio. Um bom dia para todos.